business by 10 o'clock because of some other meetings around the Capitol, so we're going to get started right away. Senator Chaudhary, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill requests an extension of the five-year rule under the TIF statutes. The subject rule limits the EDA's ability to issue new obligations after 5 years from the original date of certification. The basic history of this district is that this district was certified by Anoka County as a renewal and renovation district. It was created to assist in redeveloping a vacant Kmart site into a new housing development. Due to housing market conditions, only 10 of the townhouse units have been and condo units have been constructed. The city has serious concerns with a proportionately high number of foreclosure units located in a neighborhood just adjacent to the TIF district, and city's in the process of modifying the district to geographically add this area. The problem is, this is basically my old neighborhood. It is rapidly deteriorating and is comprised of 50 duplex units that have a 24% foreclosure rate, serious crime issues, the main crime area in Columbia Heights, and overall physical building and infrastructure decay. What we're seeking is, in summary, the ability to use monies to help redevelop this district just adjacent to the current one. This is along Central Avenue in Columbia Heights and 47th, which is, people can remember the old Kmart there, and then across the street there's the Flame Burger, which they are not seeking to redevelop, and we like our Flame Burger. But in just to the south of that, there's a very dilapidated neighborhood of apartments, duplexes, and a rundown strip mall. It's a high crime area, it's a high foreclosure area, and it needs redevelopment.
So, Senator Chaudhary, would that be about a mile south of 694?
About. Correct.
I've got a niece that bought a townhome in Columbia Heights. I got to seek her counsel on this.
Yeah. Whereabouts?
In a new development, and I've been there, and I don't even remember. I went there in the dark, so I don't remember the directions very well. But I will find out.
Is it near a lake?
It was dark, and it was in the winter. I went there for Christmas. It was dark and winter, and there was snowbanks, so I couldn't find it again. But
there are several, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Columbia Heights has done a lot in trying to help stimulate some of these new townhome developments around the city where there was old housing. There's some in the kind of the northeastern part of Columbia Heights called the Sullivan Lake area. There's a new townhome development further south, kind of more towards the city core, where there's Immaculate Conception Church and the old Northeast Electronics Institute, which was formerly our middle school and formerly our high school. So there's been a lot of work done in trying to improve the quality of the housing stock, and that's kind of what we're looking to do here too. They've done just to the east of this housing area. The city did do a similar thing many years ago. And so this is just kind of an extension of that project. This particular block is historically and widely known to be the biggest problem area. There's a McDonald's there. It was kind of the old high school hangout, but really it has gone downhill since then, and it just needs to be upgraded, not only for the sake of the city's tax base, quality of the housing stock, but also for all the other ancillary issues that surround those types of dilapidated neighborhoods.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think just what I'd like to add to this is...
If you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself.
Oh, thank you. Scott Clark, Community Development Director for the City of Columbia Heights. And I think maybe just the one other additional comments in terms of kind of the technical aspect of this is that the original condominium project did run into a series of issues. Probably the biggest one is the economic price points of this was a little bit higher than a lot of the city here, and that in addition to the fact of having what we call the Sheffield neighborhood that Senator Chaudhry just referred to has made the development of the various phases go very slowly. And in addition to that, we had the unfortunate death of the developer. And then by the time that the first phase was dealt or started, and we're looking at the second phase, is that obviously we've run into the economic issues that are out there right now. So essentially what we'd really like to do as far as this bill is concerned is that this will give the city the ability to capture the tax increment for phases 2 and 3, which will hopefully be built within the next 5 years. And without this bill here is that we would not be able to use those particular increments. And again, is that what we want to do is not to bring that increment back to the condominium project, but as Senator Chaudhry was saying, is to be able to use this as a redevelopment tool to bolster the area to the south.
But the question I had when they first came to me with the request is, the project in the current district complete in terms of the infrastructure obligations? And the answer was yes.
That's correct.
The projects within that district.
Mr. Clark, what percentage of the project in this TIF district has been built? A percentage of what you were anticipating in tax capacity?
In terms of tax capacity, it's probably built at about 35% in terms of that is concerned. In terms of actual numbers is that in terms of the first phase that is currently built here is that we view that we'll have about another $1 million of unobligated tax increment that will come off of the first phase that is currently built. And what we're looking at doing as a city is that before the five-year rule extinguishes itself in July, is that we're looking at capitalizing that future income stream off of that, again, so we can use that for the redevelopment. And then based upon a schedule of looking out probably with phases 2 and 3 built 4 or 5 years from now, because we'll think it'll take that long, is that we view that there will be another net present value coming back out that we could use of around $900,000 to $1 million. So between phase 1, which is currently there, and then with this particular bill, is that we'll be able to capture about another $1 million.
So, Senator Chaudhry, we've seen a few of these already. We anticipate the state of the economy, we're going to see more. Many projects are getting delayed, so we're going to do something on this. We're going to go back and take a look at kind of what kind of extensions have been granted in the past and try to set some kind of a standard, I think. I think between this year and next year, we're probably going to see quite a few people in the situation that Mr. Clark would find yourself in. So.
I mean, it's the classic issue of the inner ring, where we have the same type of housing situation, foreclosure rates, crime on a smaller scale proportionally, as you might see in the in one of the big cities, but we just don't have the type of tax base, the ability to collect other types of fees or income or taxes that a Minneapolis or St. Paul would to be able to fund these types of issues. And so you'll see TIF primarily coming from inner ring cities such as Columbia Heights, Fridley, and other places to try and jumpstart this redevelopment.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you, Mr. Clark. Senator
Chaudhry. Thank you, Chaudhry. Mr. Chair, members.
Chair leaves over Senate File 871 for consideration of the omnibus bill. Senator Rest is not here. Senator Pogemiller, do you have a bill?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogmeier.
Senate File 248 is a very simple bill, and the explanation of it is really, really complex. And so what I'm going to try to do is boil it down, and if the committee wants to dig deeper into it, I've got all kinds of people that can talk about it. Here's the basic situation. Years ago, we created when we were doing the Minneapolis Convention Center, we created a taxing area where the sales tax would apply so that we could pay off part of the debt for the convention center. And the taxing area was basically downtown Minneapolis. It was the area that supposedly benefited by having the convention center. If people come to conventions, they're going to use these restaurants and bars and hotels. And so the taxing district basically was downtown Minneapolis, and because we were developing the riverfront, the east side of the riverfront, the River Place side of the riverfront, which is in my community, very close to my home, where there was kind of this emerging entertainment area. And so there was a portion there carved in for the taxing district. Some of you I don't think any of you were around. The Senate Council will remember, this was the Nye's debate.
Yeah.
Is Nye's in or is Nye's out?
And Ruby's.
What?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, and Ruby's, I believe.
And Ruby's, that's yeah. Right. Ruby's Cabaret, which no longer exists. So this has been this way for, I don't know, is this 15 years? Quite a long time. 22 years? Oh, my gosh. 22 years. During that period of time, everything's gone well. All the convention center is being paid off. Everything's good. But the neighborhoods have changed slightly, and in one portion of this area that had been designated, there's been an emergence of coffee shops. Well, it's basically a coffee shop and a restaurant in a neighborhood area that is in an old industrial area. So the buildings have been rehabbed. It's been a real upgrade for the neighborhood. It's zoned residential, so you can't be open after 11 o'clock, and you can't have live entertainment. And so it's not the type of commercial it's not the type of restaurant or coffee shop that's going to benefit from the convention center. No conventioner is going to come to these places. They're basically neighborhood places. And city licensed them. They opened. And 3 or 4 or 5 years later, somebody figures out that they're actually in the taxing district. And the state has sent money to Minneapolis based on that fact, and the city of Minneapolis has accepted the money, but the restaurant never charged the tax. And so the state is basically out the money. Minneapolis benefited from getting the money, and the state is now trying to collect the money from the restaurant. When I was told that this problem existed, I said, well, no, that can't be in the district. That doesn't make any sense. But then obviously it did. It is in the line. And the way the district was drawn, it just took major streets. It was an industrial area, and so the city just took major streets and went whack, whack, whack. And basically, it's University Avenue to 35W Bridge from Hennepin Avenue. At the time the lines were drawn, nobody anticipated that someone would rehab this industrial building and turn it into a restaurant. So the city has been working with the restaurant and with the state a little bit to figure out, all right, how do we figure this out? And here's what the bill does. It says we're going to take this restaurant out of the district, but we still have this debt. And the restaurant has started to collect the sales tax. I can get the specifics on those dates. I don't have them, but they're here and they can explain that. And we're going to collect the tax until about 2012 to pay the state, to get the state whole again. And then they're going to be out of the district. So they're basically going to collect the money, but this extends the time out now for them to collect it because it's a fairly significant amount of money, and it would close the restaurant. So that's what the bill does. That's how simple it is. Why the city of Minneapolis didn't tell when they licensed them that they were in the district is kind of beyond me. You can understand that the owner of the restaurant, when they started getting letters from the Department of Revenue, is going, what's going on here? So, but with a lot of discussion, this seems to be a solution that works, keeps everybody whole, and solves the problem.
Senator Pogelmeier, do we need to do anything with potential fines or penalties that have been assessed to the restaurant?
I think not.
Somebody
I don't
from the
know
department
if the Department
here.
Of Revenue's actually signed off on this, but they're aware of the discussions. I think this is a solution that makes everybody happy, but maybe we'll find out otherwise now.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm attorney with the department. If the underlying liability is taken care of, the penalties and interest will automatically go away.
Even if it's collected over a three-year period?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that would be the intent of this. This would take care of the assessment that's on the books. The length of time they'd be collecting it would wipe out that liability in total. Mr. Chairman, I do have one question though for Senator Pogelmeier. Is the intent then to also, you mentioned a restaurant and a coffee shop. Is the intent also to capture the money from the coffee shop?
Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned the coffee shop. What's the situation with the coffee shop?
There more to the story here?
Is the coffee shop liable too?
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Johnson. I'm with the Gray Plant Moody Law Firm, but I'm also a neighbor of Alex Roberts, who is the owner of Restaurant Elma. And whether the coffee shop is in or out is going to depend on whether it falls within the definition of a restaurant, and that definition is within the Minneapolis City Ordinance. And so whether it's in or out, we'll ride on that.
And have they not been collecting the tax also?
Well, we're sure they're not being, we're sure they, well, yeah, I don't think they've collected the tax. What? Well, apparently they are currently collecting the tax. So depending on what Minneapolis decides with regards to the ordinance, they're going to be in or out.
Will we know before we put the omnibus bill together so that we can
yes.
kind of treat them the same?
We'll clarify that. I think we're talking about how much money? $115,000.
Senator Squad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pogelmeier, the way I'm understanding this is all revenue neutral to the state because
yes.
we're going to get paid back, and the city's just going to get less money, and we're going to collect less mm-hmm. money. So it's all internal in Minneapolis once the state gets paid back.
Well, this helps us with our budget deficit because we're going to get paid back in the future.
Can we borrow against this?
yes, this makes the state whole. You know, it's one of those things that you just kind of shake your head that this makes everybody whole, and the fact that the restaurant is collecting the tax now that they know they're supposed to, and they can get it done in a three-year period, I think is a solution that gets us where we want to go.
District?
I do have an A1 amendment,
this
Mr. Chairman, to clarify something.
I'm Senator Pogelmeier, I'm just talking with council about that.
It makes it clear that it's in a residential zoning district.
Their term of art. That's what they proposed.
Okay, Senator Pogelmeier moves the A1 amendment. And that just clarifies that the business actually has to be in a residence.
In a district, yes. And what that does is that zoning limits live entertainment. You can't have live entertainment. And you can't be open after 11, I think it is. So it's not, it's a neighborhood place. It's not meant to be an entertainment giant. It's a fabulous restaurant. It is, so for Ms. Zoff's Vial, this is the restaurant Alma, A-L-M-A provision. We had the Nye's provision, now we have the restaurant Alma provision. Assuming the committee is supportive.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Dibble, is this bill a good idea?
Well, Restaurant Alma is an outstanding restaurant. Everyone should check it out.
Should we forgive their $100,000 of tax liability?
It's an important viable business, adding vitality to the neighborhoods of Minneapolis, and it means jobs.
Is that a yes?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And they're going to pay it. Or their customers
right.
are going to pay it.
Right. Anything further? Chair lays over Senate File 248 as amended for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate it. Slap Minneapolis's hand.
Senator Dibble.
Tom. Your hands go.
Whichever you want.
Mr. Chair and members, we'll start with, I'm going to present Senate File 1184 first. That's a bill being carried by Senator Rest. I'm a co-author of that bill, and Senator Rest, unfortunately, is ill today, but there are a number of people here prepared to testify and help explain the bill, probably a little more eloquently than I will be able to, but I'll provide a quick overview. I think first, though, Mr. Chair, we need to offer the A1 amendment. I'll offer the A1.
To get the bill in the shape that Senator Dibble wants it, he offers the A1 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Senator Dibble on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relying heavily on counsel's description, I'll just summarize. The bill would increase by up to 10 percentage points the permitted amount of expenditures for activities located outside of the geographic area of the district so that it won't be in violation of anti-pooling provisions of TIF law. The purpose, of course, is to develop housing not to exceed 150% of market value, and all the purposes that we're familiar with for these housing districts, acquisition, relocation, demolition, et cetera. The parcel has to contain a residence containing 1 to 4 family dwelling units. It has some authority to allow increments to be expended after the expiration date if in fact they're paying off bonds. Allows Brooklyn Park to come in to this idea, as we do now for Crystal, Fridley, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Richfield, and Columbia Heights. And then, of course, provides for Brooklyn Park to designate up to 100 parcels to be in a housing district, and increases the authorization for Crystal, Fridley, and Richfield from 50 to 100. Has, a, of course, local city match requirement to pay at least 25% from its general fund or a levy or other unrestricted dollars. And then there's also a Section 4 Act. I haven't looked at that. I maybe need to take a glance at that. But that concerns the city of St. Paul. Senator Waugh allows the housing replacement district to become effective for St. Paul without local approval. Mr. Chair, we have some testifiers here. I'll just invite them to come forward on their own initiative. Oh, Melissa Manderscheid is here, and she can provide some information or testimony for the committee.
Thank you, Chairs, members. Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Melissa Manderscheid. I'm an attorney at Kennedy & Graven, and I'm here today as the coordinator of the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council. I've been asked to provide some brief opening remarks that highlight the nature and the degree of our state's foreclosure crisis. Just in general, I did provide a handout of the 8 slides that I've been referring to, and then a map of the state of Minnesota. There's an orange side and a blue side. The Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council is Minnesota's coordinated approach to address our state's foreclosure crisis. The council includes representatives from city, county, and state government, as well as nonprofits who serve the metro and greater Minn. We work to coordinate our efforts to address the foreclosure crisis in the state, and we have our efforts more thoroughly described in a coordinated plan, which I will make available to you all. It's about ready to go to print, so I didn't provide copies of the draft version for you. The goal of the Partners Council is to identify, fund, and implement coordinated statewide policies and programs that effectively address the impact of the recent surge in mortgage foreclosures on families, neighborhoods, and communities. This effort is funded through the generous support of the Family Housing Fund, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and the Twin Cities Local Initiative Support Corporation. There's a chart in your handout that was prepared by HousingLink. It shows a dramatic increase in foreclosures from 2005 to 2008. As you can see, both Greater Minn and the Metro have experienced a dramatic increase. In 2008, Minnesota experienced more than 26,000 foreclosures. This is up from 6,000 or so in 2005. So as you can see, a dramatic increase of nearly 20,000 in just 3 years. There are also a few photographs here that provide some examples of what the problem looks like in the state of Minnesota. One of the challenges for our urban neighborhoods and city departments is that foreclosed homes must be boarded in order to secure them. However, these same boards announce to the community that these homes are vacant and unattended and often lead to vandalism and neighborhood instability. There have been many experiments with different techniques that are alternatives to the boarding, but by and large, they're not cost-effective, and they haven't really prevented trespassing and theft. And typically in Greater Minn, you have a lot of subdivisions that have become ghost towns for a variety of reasons. You have virtually block after block of undeveloped subdivisions it's obvious from the sidewalk that these homes are foreclosed and empty, and oftentimes these foreclosures are clustered throughout a particular subdivision. Studies show that each additional foreclosure in a neighborhood results in a 1% drop in surrounding property values. So when you have a ghost town, it clearly impacts the surrounding property values. And oftentimes there'll be one or two folks that are occupying a house in a subdivision, and so their property values are just abysmal. I also provided some specific information for the city of Brooklyn Park as an example for the committee today. The numbers of foreclosures in Hennepin County has increased sevenfold in the past 5 years. Every community has experienced foreclosures, and you'll hear some more about that today. But Brooklyn Park has the third most foreclosures of any other city in the state. In 2008 alone, there were 983 foreclosures in Brooklyn Park. The map that I provided in the handout shows those foreclosures with green circles. In 2007 and 2008 combined, there were 1,576 foreclosures in the city. Coupled with that, you have vacant properties. There are 756 known vacant properties in the city, and that's represented by red triangles on the map. As you can see, every neighborhood in Brooklyn Park has been affected by foreclosures and vacancies. Just by way of scale of this of the challenge that a city like Brooklyn Park is facing, it received $3.9 million in federal NSP funding as a pass-through from the Hennepin County, and it has additional funds from the Minnesota Housing Challenge funds from about 3 years ago. So couple those two together, that's $3.9 million. That will allow the city to only address about 78 foreclosures. This is less than 5% of the problem that they have, and it leaves about 1,500 or so properties for the private market to address. This situation is very familiar to local governments that are saddled with all these foreclosures and vacant properties. So the bill that's being discussed today will certainly go a long way in helping them with additional tools to address the problem. Some of you may have seen the 60-minute segment from mid-December. There was a prominent investment fund manager whose name is Mr. Tilson. He was commenting on the situation that we have in our country. He commented, and I just think this his quote is sort of folksy, and I still want to repeat it today. He said, holy cow, things are going to be a lot worse than anyone anticipates. There's a chart in your materials that has some orange bars going like this and some yellow bars going like this. The orange bars show the wave of subprime loan foreclosures that we've just experienced, and the next wave in yellow, the one that's going up, is just about to begin. We're just at the base of it now, and you can see there's a dramatic increase projected. The blue arrow on the chart shows where we are today, so we're just on the cusp of this next batch of resets of Alt-A and Option ARM loans. The scary part about all this is that Mr. Tilson predicted that 70% of the homeowners with these yellow bar loans will default, and many will default during their teaser rate period. That's even prior to the reset. So it's just very, very scary. The next chart is Minnesota's specific situation. The red bars on this chart show the subprime loans that have already, as the last chart illustrates, they're decreasing in quantity, but you can see that the growing blue lines represent the Alt-A loans that are on the horizon. The peak of our state's Alt-A resets will be in 2011. For those of you who are unfamiliar with what the term Alt-A means, These loans are near prime, and they're often option arms, which means that there was a period of time where the borrower paid less than the full mortgage payment each month, but then when that period ends, the monthly mortgage payments change to a new monthly rate. With the drop in interest rates, those option arms are not typically experiencing the types of dramatic jumps that they had in the past. But as the last slide shows, and Mr. Tilson commented on, many folks are failing to make their mortgage payments before the reset even occurs. So the defaults are not unique to the fact that they have an option arm. As we all know, the economy is in a tough situation here, so job losses continues to be a challenge for folks and a reason that people are going into default. The next chart here is a map that uses the information from the past chart and shows the location of these loans throughout our state. The shaded areas, the blue areas, show where the subprime loans are, and then the ones that are crosshatch shows where those Alt-A loans are. Those are the ones that are going to reset and peak in 2011. So clearly, it's a metro challenge, but it's also throughout our state, in all parts of the state. And then finally, I provided my contact information. As I mentioned, I'll be providing the coordinated plan for your background information. But I also thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today to provide this important information.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I see we have, I'm sorry. Oh, I see we have three other folks on the list here. Or come forward as you would like. You're Sherry?
I'm Sherry.
This is Sherry Pemberton from the city of St. Paul. And Paul Bolin from Fridley, who's the HRA Assistant Executive Director.
Good morning. I'm Sherry Pemberton with the City of St. Paul. I'm here to talk about the reauthorization of the St. Paul part of the Housing Replacement District. We were approved back in 1995, and at that time we felt that the market was starting to turn around and the land values were high enough, so we did not exercise our ability to form the Housing Replacement District. We think now that the vacancy rates have raised and the foreclosures have increased according to the maps I have provided you in here, this is a needed tool in order to leverage additional funds. The first round of NSP funds have been presented to the city and the state as a whole. The next round in the stimulus bill is going to be competitive, so the ability to leverage those funds in a competitive application would help us. The packet that's been passed around just gives you a quick overview of what's happening in St. Paul. And if you go to the third page where it talks about growth of vacant buildings, our vacant buildings have always averaged right around 400 or 500. And so you can see how they have increased. The end of last year, we ended at 2,000. We're now at 2,031. We are averaging about 30 additional each month. And then I've also given you copies of the maps where they're located so you can see their concentration. We had 2,224 foreclosures in St. Paul last year, and the estimate for this year is another 2,300, even with some of the lenders are putting on moratoriums on the foreclosures. They're still being processed because of what Bonnie Bollock had talked about earlier. Melissa had talked about earlier. The funding needs for the neighborhood recovery, we've anticipated that there's a need to address this issue of $100 million. The foreclosures in vacant buildings right now are about 4,000. The NSP funds and the local funds that we're currently using will address about 300 properties. That's 7.5% of the problem, and the problem continues to grow. And we look at being able to use the Housing Replacement District to provide another source of funding in the toolbox and to be able to help us be more competitive on applications for additional money. And the last page is just the results that we hope to achieve. And this is going to be a long-term effort with what's going on with the economic crisis right now.
Chairman Bach, committee members, I'm Paul Bolin from the City of Fridley Housing and Redevelopment Authority. I'll just touch briefly on Fridley's piece of this bill. Like a number of other fully developed cities, Fridley has been hit very hard by this mortgage foreclosure crisis. Over the past 2 years, approximately 2% of our housing stock has been foreclosed upon. In 2008 alone, we had 140 foreclosures, which is 1.1% of our housing stock. Also between 2007 and 2008, as a result of the market and the foreclosures, our median home value has declined from $205,000 to $179,000. Foreclosures have become a nuisance and a great expense to the city. Water bills go unpaid. Maintenance is left up to the city to hire contractors to do nuisance abatements on these properties, cut the grass all summer, and we put that against the property, but it's a number of years before any of that will be paid back. And recently, we've had squatters now showing up in a number of these vacant foreclosed homes. The bill before you today reauthorizes legislation that Fridley previously was granted and participated in from 1995 until 2004, when the existing bill expired. Over the course of that period, Fridley did acquire 21 properties under this program. You'll recall that in the early 2000s, property values rose extremely quickly, and it was more difficult in those years to acquire properties through this program. Now, with all the foreclosures we've had, with the drops in value, it would be an excellent time to reintroduce this program into the city of Fridley. Looking at some of the uses for this funding, it would be a tool the city of Fridley could have to address some of these problems on our own or in partnership with other groups, use this money to leverage other funds. Unlike St. Paul or Brooklyn Park, Fridley did not get a direct allocation from the Neighborhood Revitalization Program. Rather, Anoka County received a total of $2.3 million. And with that $2.3 million, countywide, they only have enough funding to purchase somewhere between 5 and 10 homes for demolition, and up to another 20 that they would purchase and rehabilitate. With that, I would encourage a favorable recommendation from this committee.
If they've done 50 already, they could. We'll make sure. Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Double.
Mr. Casserly on the witness list. He's here to respond to questions if there are questions from the committee.
So, Mr. Boland, did the city of Fridley do in their 10-year span do 50 units?
We did 21. Units over that time frame.
And the authority has expired?
Correct. The authority expired in 2004.
Any other questions? You have anybody else, Senator Double?
No, Mr. Chair.
Questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Senator Dibble, if it's you or maybe even Senate Counsel would want to answer. Mm-hmm. So you've got a housing TIF district with these scattered houses. Is the TIF a revenue come off those individual houses as a TIF district? Is that what the purpose of this is?
Mr. Chair, the short answer is yes. I believe the TIF is pooled. I mean, all these individual parcels are pooled, and so the increment comes from the from the increase in value
on each individual parcel pooled together.
Yeah,
so they're okay. Just so thank you.
Anything else, members? Senator Sundrum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, can you? I'm trying to grasp this concept. So we have the TIF district. And, the value of that is to capture the gap, so to speak, between existing values and new values. And new values are accruing in the same district because of what? And it, and I say that because it seems like maybe the values, at least at this point in time, are devaluating as a result of all these foreclosures and and just the situation. I'm trying to understand where we find the gap.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
The purpose of the housing TIF district is so that the city can acquire, demolish, you know, prepare, and then turn, you know, turn that those properties over for redevelopment purposes. So that, you know, the city will acquire and own the parcel, prepare it, and then turn it over to the private sector, typically to redevelop. And so a new house will be built on the parcel that will and be sold into the private market, and be, of course, of greater value. You know, and it's for housing up to 150% of market value. Rehab is also here are the specific purposes. Cost of the site acquisition, relocation, demolition of existing structures, site preparation, and pollution abatement.
Okay.
And so then, of course, the increased value, the increment that's captured is upon resale when it gets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Senator?
Yeah.
Mr. Casserly?
Casserly, and I work with Minnesota Solutions. I'm also a legal counsel for the Housing Redevelopment Authority in the city of Fridley. Just so the senator raised a good point, in a housing replacement district, it is only the individual parcels that are part of the district. It's just those specific parcels you put in. And the reason that the housing replacement district works, it's limited to 15 years. But what it does is it captures the value of any improvement. So it's just the land that becomes the base for the district. And the value of the improvement, even the current existing value, is included when you calculate tax increment. It's unlike how other districts work, which is why it's limited to a shorter term.
Anything further, members?
So, Mr. Chair, it's important to understand, at least for me, it's important to understand that this is kind of the public side of the response to the foreclosure crisis. Gets to some of those larger community issues. It won't, of course, rescue necessarily folks who are experiencing foreclosure, but of course, you know, there's a couple of different facets to this problem. One of the major facets is, of course, abandoned properties that then, you know, just sit there and then get back into the market. So this allows for some community response to those abandoned properties. It doesn't respond to individuals in crisis necessarily, but allows for a larger community benefit as more and more houses are abandoned, become derelict. At least the city will have a tool to respond to those and get those back into the market.
Senator Dibble, didn't we deal with this for the city of Minneapolis last year?
I'm sorry?
Didn't we raise the number of units the city of Minneapolis could do last year?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And what is all that increment then gets spent on that's captured?
Mr. Chair, it gets spent on those purposes that I just enumerated. The site acquisition, relocation, demolition, site preparation, pollution abatement, et cetera.
Really just to get the property ready for development.
Exactly.
So we're not mowing grass on other vacant properties?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what the city of Fridley has done with it, too. It's really been to acquire properties that are essentially vacant and very deteriorated and either tear the structures down or work with the private sector to try to rehabilitate and sell them.
Give it legs. Senator Moaz, is a good idea.
Mr. Chair, it's a great idea. Over the interim, Representative Karen Clark and I convened a lot of housing stakeholders to have a conversation about how we could, in a very responsible way, respond to this housing crisis that we have. This is one way that we could. I mean, while we can't do much on the front end with all the foreclosures, and there's a whole different set of efforts that are being done on that. our cities now have all these vacant and abandoned properties, and we actually have people who want to buy properties because of the low interest rates. And the best way that we could really stimulate the housing market to bring it some stability is to give our cities the tools they need to do to put these properties back on the market. And I think this is a very fine proposal.
Maybe, Senator Waugh, there are additional communities that would like to use this considering the housing situation.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And, in fact, in the working groups that we talked about this over the interim, our intention was to have a very geographic focus on the different efforts. And so as we map the different tools, this is what we call these the different tools that we want to put into the toolbox of our local government. Our intention is to put these tools together, and where it is appropriate and local governments feel that this would be helpful to them, we certainly would like them to make use of it. And I think that this is a very good effort on the part of the cities here to do this, but I know that other communities in Western and Greater Minnesota also have a need, and we definitely should help them achieve that.
But, Senator Moore, this bill doesn't do that yet.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, if we want to expand to do that, I mean, I think that's certainly our prerogative. I also think, though, that the local governments that are involved would be willing to and would have to engage in that conversation. I understand, though, that some of the conversations has taken place. It's not limited to just the metro area. In our meetings, you know, we had the mayor of Detroit Lakes. We had housing advocates from all over the state coming in to have those meetings with us. So it isn't that the advocacy community is unaware of some of these tools that have been put on the table. I mean, Ms. Pemberton and others could chime in, but I think this has been a pretty open process as we're trying to identify the maximum number of tools that we can offer to our local government. And I don't know why other cities or other areas of the state aren't coming forward. But
I think, Senator Moore, maybe I'll have a discussion with the League about that. Senator Double?
Mr. Chair, Bonnie Bollock just pointed out to me that the 10% flexibility for expenditures outside the district, that first section one, you know, where you look down on 2.26, so the 10% you can flex from TIF districts is available statewide. So there, that does create some resources in other communities that have other TIF districts.
But not as a part of the housing replacement district.
Not per se, but it can be used for housing purposes.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogelman.
I might have missed this at the very beginning, so I apologize.
Let's talk about the first section.
Nelson.
The area around a station is going to be ripe for development.
Set aside more.
Why is the additional subsidy needed to direct the type of development?
Well, we're on, that's my next bill.
Other districts, right.
We're on the rest bill.
Oh.
So now I know what you're going to ask on my next bill.
We're still on the and rest bill.
Did you already do the Dibble bill?
No. You can save up your fire for the next bill.
Senator Pullman, this is Senator Rest's bill.
He didn't look like Senator Rest.
Chair is being very lenient, considering he's not even an author on the bill.
I am.
Happens to be a
Senator
Boyes.
Yes.
Dirt. Okay. No, I'm sorry. Anything further, members? Chair lays over Senate File 1184 as amended. Thank you, Senator Double.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All right, now we can get to Senator Pogano's question. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 975. Which creates is a new idea for economic development district TIFs. Allows for the establishment of these districts in the newly defined transit improvement areas that we established last year. And working with the Public Facilities Authority in order to establish districts like this. We established the policy, but had no resources, of course, to apply towards that. But the idea is that cities, municipalities that are going to be receiving transitways, fixed-way transitways through their communities are doing that, of course, to provide very important transportation service. Part of transportation is, of course, getting to where you need to go. And as we know in transportation and land use policy, how we do our major infrastructure investments like transportation also has a lot to do with how we develop and redevelop those destinations, where they're actually going to wind up, where housing, schools, workplaces, amenities, shopping, cultural, you name it. And one of the benefits of fixed investments like transitway is that we can create a lot of locational efficiency, take advantage of, in large part, existing infrastructure like sewers and nearby roads and et cetera. So a lot of the development in the metropolitan area as we contemplate receiving a million more people in the coming decade or so is going to be focused in some fairly specific areas. It's going to have to be, or we won't be able to afford to build all of the supporting infrastructure and all of the new communities out on the fringe and all of the parking lots and police departments and schools, et cetera, that go with that. So in order to support the kind of development that will be occurring in the vicinity of these transit stations, we've established the concept of the transit improvement area, keyed off of the concepts of transit-oriented development, and that will take, to answer Senator Pogemiller's question, I think, you know, some of the area around that will need some public investment for the kinds of public infrastructure. It's not going at all for the transit purposes, the transit line itself, the transit station itself, those sorts of things. But the area around those stations is going to likely see some increase in value, significant in some cases. Certainly as land is going to receive more uses. And so the increment is thus created and allows a tool for those municipalities to provide some resources to do the public side improvements. So very quickly, just as by way of summary, it adds activities in a transit improvement area into the public purpose and eligible use for an economic development TIF district. Allows the city to pool an additional 10% from other TIF districts within the city's jurisdiction for affordable housing. It also has current law allows cities to use revenues generated within TIF districts located in a deed-designated bioscience zone throughout the zone for area-wide infrastructure and redevelopment costs. And so this proposes that the city be authorized to use the revenue generated in TIF districts located in transit improvement areas throughout the transit improvement area for those purposes. And that's a summary of the proposal, Mr. Chair. If there is a briefing paper, and you know, if you're interested in how the these TIAs are defined, I have a copy of that statute that we passed last year. If folks would like to see that, I don't think that's in your handouts. We'll start with Dave Van Haddam from Transit for
Liberty. Where's the definition of transit?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Van Haddam. I am program manager with Transit for Livable Communities. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy organization with over 9,000 members in the metro. Our mission is quite simple, to increase the transportation choices, bus, train, bike, and walking that Minnesotans have both to get to work and in their communities. We obviously strongly support Senate File 975. I'd like to touch on two main points here this morning. First, I'd like to just brief you very quickly on the status of transit ways and transit improvement areas in the metro, and that extends outside of the metro, as I'll get to in a moment. And then secondly, I'd like to just touch on why the TOD, transit-oriented development, is so critical to leveraging that investment we've made in these transit ways. So today, with the Hiawatha up and running, which opened in 2004, we have 17 transit improvement areas, or those stations, By 2020, we may have another 80. This year, in 2009, we're expecting another 21 as North Star opens, North Star Commuter Rail and the I-35W Bus Rapid Transit and Cedar, some portion of the Cedar Bus Rapid Transit.
Right here.
By 2014, we'd see Central open, 2015, Southwest possibly, and then by 2020, Rush Line, Red Rock, I-94 East, Robert Street, and Botno. Most of these, we're well on our way to doing these through the passage of the Comprehensive Transportation Bill last year, and very critically leveraging federal contribution, which I'll come back to in the end. On the capital side for these transitways, it's typical that we would get a 50% federal match if our application is selected. I do want to note, in addition to these metro lines and all of these metro transit stations, you do start to see connections throughout the state. This year, Minnesota will make an application to the Federal Rail Administration for intercity passenger rail, high-speed rail connection. This is part of the federal economic stimulus package. There's $8 billion available nationally, and Minnesota will apply both for the Northern Lights Express passenger rail to Duluth and a connection, a high-speed rail connection to Chicago, going to St. Paul's Union Depot, possibly to Minneapolis, and explored connections to Rochester. So we have this system moving forward. The county's Transit Improvement Board, which you authorized to form last year, is managing this process along with Met Council, Metro Transit, and obviously all of the local communities. Let me shift gears and just briefly touch on some of the key points of why transit-oriented development and having strategies to advance these transit improvement areas is so important. As Senator Dibble mentioned, this does, the data is out there nationally along the Hiawatha that these transit stations increase property values. The reason they do that is they increase access for people, non-auto access. The Urban Land Institute nationally found that cities that do these kind of transit and land use collaborative processes, people drive on average 20 to 40% less. So that saves a lot of money for the individual consumer. It also saves a lot of money to our local and state economy, again, as Senator Dibble alluded to. A few years back, the Met Council predicted that savings would be $3 billion by 2020 in terms of reduced need for local roads and sewers. In the state of Utah, they're doing this kind of compact development statewide and imagine $15 billion in savings statewide through this same sort of transit and land use connection. Third reason this is so important is we are fairly certain that energy efficiency is going to be the linchpin of the new economy. And we know that today public transit on average uses one half the energy per passenger mile as does driving alone. When this system is fully built out and we have the support of housing and other land uses, we'll do even better than that. The governor's Climate Change Advisory Committee reached a similar conclusion, saying that improved land use planning and development strategies are a critical component of reaching the state's goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We don't get there without this set of strategies. So two conclusions. One, as I mentioned, we need to be competitive for that 50% federal match. We're talking about billions of dollars over the next 20 years. And one of the ways the feds evaluate the state proposals is their land use component. How serious are the localities in advancing a set of strategies to leverage these transitways? So conclusion number one. Conclusion number two, this bill is a very important way to advance the ability of localities to put all these pieces together to make the environment more conducive to walking, biking, getting to the transit station, getting from a bus station to a train station or a train station to a train station, et cetera, et cetera. So we strongly support this bill and are happy to answer any questions you might have.
Sure. We have Mike Christensen from the City of Minneapolis. He's the Chief Planning and Development Officer. He's with the Community Planning and Economic Development Office, and he has been responsible for planning and development supports and worked on the Hiawatha Line and other transit routes throughout the city of Minneapolis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Dibble, for including me in the group this morning testifying to this important legislation. The case for this legislation is Hiawatha Flats at 44th and Hiawatha. Hiawatha Flats is an apartment building two blocks from the 46th Street stop on the red line on your map. It's a beautiful building. It has a swimming pool. It has a fitness center. It has a theater inside, and it's market-rate apartment. It is exactly the kind of development we want to see near the Hiawatha line. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a very good sidewalk. And unfortunately, it's near five railroad tracks that are part of the transition from this part of Minneapolis's industrial zone to a more modern transit-oriented use. But it's the right building at the right time, and it's exactly what this city, what the city of Minneapolis and what the state of Minnesota want to see around their transit-related investments. People who look at this apartment building to live there report that they're very likely to locate next to a light rail line, except for the lack of sidewalk and pedestrian-oriented lighting in the area of the station area. And so that demographic, which is likely to work downtown, is exactly the demographic we'd like to see living in Hiawatha Flats. Right now, if you own an apartment building in the city of Minneapolis, you're doing pretty well. You're likely to have a vacancy rate of about 5% or less. Our rental vacancy rate, unlike our other vacancy rate caused by foreclosure, is actually quite small. So apartments are a good investment in the city of Minneapolis. At Hiawatha Flats, next to a light rail line with a swimming pool, with a fitness center, with a theater, currently the vacancy rate is over 40%. The reason is not because it isn't a great rental opportunity, not because it's in a marketplace that isn't hot for rentals. The reason is it lacks just simple infrastructure between the apartment building and the station area. So this tool, this economic development tool, would offer the opportunity for the city to work with five or six developers, 10 or 15 developers around a station area, build out the street or the sidewalks, the lighting, for the purposes of fully supporting what we know is hot in Minneapolis, which is the transit-oriented housing experience. So we appreciate this opportunity to talk about what we're seeing along the Hiawatha Light Rail Line and the difference that this legislation would make to allow the city to work with private developers in a way that allows them to take a transit-oriented development and make their investments in their property tax bases work in the short term to develop the sidewalks and lighting we need around these station areas.
Senator Dibble, I agree. I think a lot of development's going to happen around all these transit stations, but aren't we potentially taking an awful lot of tax capacity off? I mean, capturing an awful lot of new growth. We all know what the pressure on property taxes is. And if we're going to capture all this new capacity, don't we put just a lot of additional pressure on the current property by not taking advantage of any of this new development that we know is going to happen?
That's a fair question, Mr. Chair. At the same time, in order for municipalities to really create these districts around the station and guide the development, this is an opportunity to do that, as Mr. Christensen just described, working with a number of developers that are looking at particular, and creating an area-wide plan and having some assurance that the supporting infrastructure is going to be there. Spark that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Is there money in the
Transit Improvement Loan Program at the state level?
Mr. Chair.
Where do those loans come from?
There are no resources. We established the policy, established the framework, but have yet to come up with resources for this loan purpose. We're hoping to, at some point allow for bonding to fill up some.
Well, I think the Senator Pogemiller's part, wouldn't some kind of a loan program or a bonding program be a better idea than capturing all this new tax capacity?
Mr. Chair, we can talk to Senator Langseth about, bonding would be great, if we had the ability to do that.
I wasn't thinking about state bonding. Senator Langseth, were you thinking about state bonding?
No, I wouldn't think about that at all.
What,
Senator Pogemiller?
What I'm not clear, Mr. Christensen, is if the economy were normal, these would be the prime locations for development. Why are we looking to subsidize those? Aren't we typically trying to subsidize the ones where they're not prime locations for other reasons?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Pogumil, as you know, the city is now limiting its TIF use to affordable housing, blight removal, and job creation in challenged neighborhoods of the city. We don't do downtown TIF anymore, as you will follow. So market rate deals in Minneapolis are basically unsubsidized. Secondly, the point made here that, in fact, we ought to be protecting the property tax base of the city is the primary focus of the City Council's review of every tax increment financing deal I bring in front of them. So, for example, Coloplast, which you know is the North American headquarters of a Danish company that's located at 1601 West River Road in one of the most blighted areas in the city, is coming in to the city of Minneapolis spending $35 million, and the TIF note on that deal is $2.9 million on a $35 million project. So what this would allow us to do is to break out a very small part of the project and ask developers to contribute small parts of their projects to building the pedestrian experience around these light rail station areas. So we're not talking about walking in and taking the whole project, Mr. Chair, but just a small portion of it. It's a tool that we could use very well by pooling small parts of market rate deals in the 46th Street area, for example. So in the case of Coloplast, which is a corporate headquarters, it's about 5% of the total deal that's being financed through a TIF note. Here, this would be a small part of market rate deals, and we would not propose to subsidize apartment buildings, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogumiller, out of this pool.
Why, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogumiller.
So you've got a building there that could work. It's two blocks away. And I don't mean to make this sound like a naive question, but why wouldn't the city put a sidewalk in? But why do you need to ask an increment from somewhere else in the city to do that sidewalk? I know it's not just a sidewalk. It's more of a transit-oriented sidewalk. But why wouldn't that be in the normal course of event of city activity on sidewalks and streets and
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogumiller, as you know, you're having a wonderful debate up here about local government aids. In the city of Minneapolis, the net debt bonding maintenance budget for the Public Works Department is $14 million. We are not going to build any new sidewalks when we have potholes in the Lake of the Isles Parkway and other important places in the city. So the LGA discussion up here also relates to our ability to build sidewalks. Having said that, as you well know, we are able to build longer term around these station areas, and we will, sidewalks and pedestrian lighting, but it's incremental and it takes us more time. So we've got lighting now around some of the important station areas.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
You know, I think it's a couple of points. One is, you know, it's certainly conceivable, you know, that this, you know, this could be scaled in some way if, you know, if there's concern about capturing the total increment. I certainly understand that. I actually don't expect that capturing the total increment from the approved value around these stations would be needed by a long shot. Secondly, you know, when you talk about bonding and the like, you're typically, you know, that's driven by TIF resources. You're talking about, you know, attributing those improvements to a particular business or entity, and these are area-wide improvements that will benefit. That's the whole premise of transit-oriented development is mixed use, locational efficiency, lots of different types of uses, cultural, business, housing, education, you name it. And so, you know, it'd be hard to attribute that benefit to a particular entity. So, you know, this is about, you know, capturing a little bit of increment, create area-wide plans, area-wide concept for, you know, for the vital infrastructure that goes way beyond just, you know, just a sidewalk, but, you know, creates kind of vitality in the public realm that then attracts the kind of development we're talking
about. Mr. Chairman?
It's not just putting a train down in a station.
Senator, you know, Senator Pogemiller, you know, Senator Dibble, we're also allowing in these districts to capture 10% and spend it somewhere else. So, I mean, it's not even really just about the sidewalk or whatever public improvement we want to make. It's bigger than that.
Oh, yeah.
On development that we think is going to happen anyway. Senator Pogemiller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, here's where maybe I'm – you've got several things going on here. And based on Mr. Christensen's comments just now, why are you even worried about a district designated by deed? Just cut them out of the deal. Just say you, if the argument is we don't have enough now in our basic infrastructure funds to pay for filling the potholes and redoing the current sidewalks we have, therefore it's going to be hard priority-wise to build a new sidewalk in an industrial area. Shouldn't the argument just be, or couldn't the argument just be, that's our problem? Forget about the state. Just allow us to use some of our TIF money to build that sidewalk because that's going to enhance our development opportunities in that new area. I'm confused why you're even dealing with the TIF, with the Transit Improvement District. What does that bring to the table? Because I think that's what's starting to concern the chairman because that sounds like we're taking a lot of tax base off the tax rolls, whereas if all we're trying to do is build that sidewalk, and maybe that's not all we're trying to do. If all we're trying to do is build the sidewalk, though, you're just looking for another revenue source, and you're saying give us a little more flexibility in the city to build the sidewalk, and one of the areas where we do have some money is in our TIF districts. So let us take a little of those TIF monies and build the sidewalk.
Senator Pogemiller, there's no but-for test on the development. Development's going to happen.
It seems like it would. It just seems like you got two things going on here at once, and maybe there's a good reason for that. But,
Mr. Chair, I think you know the transit improvement area, you know, designation that we established within you know deed provides for a process that a city can work, you know, to designate a district, and it's not just you know drawing a.
Right. No, I read the statute.
Doing all of these things. That's more than just you know, building sidewalks, creating you know an area-wide plan that has some specific goals and purposes. And you know I understand the but-for test, but it's just as easy also to see you know very inefficient. So I think the but-for is really on the type of development that's going to be occurring in that area.
But Senator Dibble, doesn't the city approve the development plan? I mean. Isn't the city in control of what that development plan looks like?
Right, and this creates a kind of a way of recognizing kind of what some of those desirable plan elements are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Bolich, and I represent Minnesota Solutions, a statewide group of cities and housing and redevelopment authorities, and we're bringing this proposal forward along with the League and Metro Cities. We reference the deed transit improvement areas simply because it was already defined in law. It's already a public policy that has been adopted by the legislature to focus on transit-oriented development. This particular bill actually, and I think what gets confusing is there are two different funding mechanisms really in this bill, and one is the one that I believe Senator Pogemiller was referring to, which would allow a city to pool from any tax increment district an additional 10% over what is already allowed from any tax increment district in the city and focus those revenues within a transit improvement area. It also allows a city to establish a tax increment financing district within a transit improvement area, meeting the current law criteria, for instance, for a redevelopment district. We don't change that. We don't change that a city would still have to meet criteria that are in law for those tax increment financing districts, but again, allowing the pooling of the revenues from those districts a little bit more broadly than currently allowed by law. Within these transit improvement areas, we were searching for a way to allow some state agency to include input from the Department of Transportation and the Met Council for a statewide proposal, and that is why we relied on the already adopted definition of a transit improvement area. And I do wish to add that the area-wide infrastructure that we're really short on resources to support exceed the benefit to any one particular business. They are often, it's efficient to provide this infrastructure, to build this infrastructure at the time the station's going in. It's often necessary to have the infrastructure in place to attract the kinds of businesses that will actually enhance ridership. This just gives more flexibility to a local government that's going to get some huge transit investment and wants to make sure that they're getting as many riders as possible and not getting uses entrenched that will be very costly, if not impossible, to change over time.
Senator Pullman.
So is there not enough money built into the development of the transit system to create transit stations designed in a way that are developer-ready around them? It sounds like we've not built the stations well enough.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, the station funding is distinctly, well, not always distinctly different. There is a little bit of gray area, but it's different from the development around it. And I think that we probably haven't fully funded the transit lines. Dave Van Haddam can probably address that better than I do, but just better than I can. But I'm assuming that there's probably some gaps even with that by itself. The development, shaping the development around the station is something that I know that there are gaps in financing for. There are not enough resources. Even traditional state programs that we have that help us, for instance, some Met Council funding might be on the line. There's also the prospect of the redevelopment account is going to be out of money. So a lot of those programs and things that we use to help us with those infrastructure needs are diminishing, even as our need to take a very proactive and aggressive view of development around these transit stations is increasing. And as Dave Van Haddam said, we also need these additional resources to be competitive for this new round of federal stimulus funding.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogemiller.
How are stations paid for? I might be missing something here.
Oh, Mr. Chair, the stations themselves are they're fairly discrete, defined, you know, and part of the transit line itself.
And how's that paid for?
Through the traditional transit
stations. Okay, so if you're putting a station at an intersection, there happens to be a moat, you got to get over the moat. Can that be paid for? Can that bridge over the moat be paid for with the transit station? Or you get your transit station, you just don't get to get over the moat. That's up to the city to get you over the moat.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think so. Within reason. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's transit stations are defined to the, you know, to the public right of way that's designated for the transit.
It seems like we should do
area.
Some work there.
I'm
not criticizing. I'm just saying it seems like we might want to do some work there to get good transit stations, because the idea of putting the station there is for people to be able to get on the train.
Mr. Chair.
And if the city's got to pay for the bridge over, I use an outrageous example. If the city's got to pay for the bridge to get over the moat,
Mr. Chair, and maybe Senator Dibble could speak to this, but the formula that goes into the transit project, it's sort of the cost analysis that goes into that. And so sometimes, Senator Pogemiller, and I know you know this, but as part of that calculation, I think that the tendency may be in some instances to minimize the added cost at the stations because of the cost input factors that go into costing out the project. And so I think at the end of the day, there's some trade-offs get made where the funding for the transit project shortchanges things like the bridge over the moat because of the cost calculations that go into it. That's been our experience, and I'm, you know,
you could probably speak to that better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ma is referring to the Federal Transit Administration's Cost Effectiveness Index, which we may, people who, of course, are represented by Chairman Oberstar probably have heard a lot about that. It's a very, very narrow measure of how we determine whether or not a particular transitway is viable. And it really only relates to cost savings as a measure of travel itself, and doesn't allow for any of the external measures or the co-benefits to be measured and factored in as a criteria for determining the larger community benefit, environmental, locational efficiency, redevelopment opportunities, economic opportunities for individuals in the area, those sorts of things. It's a big problem that we live with right now. It's why many, many aspects of the transitways themselves that are under consideration have been lopped off of the Central Corridor, Hiawatha, North Star. That's why North Star is only going halfway to St. Cloud right now. So it's a good point. The world might be changing, but there are also diminishing resources all over.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble has stated it well. Our experience in Minneapolis and Senator Pogamiller raises the question that the City Council is constantly pondering as to what investments need to be made in these station areas. This economic development tool would allow a districting of property owners that we can say now are likely to own property that will go up in value. So that we around a station area, according to a Humphrey Institute study reported out in November, values are increasing at higher than city averages around these station areas, particularly to the west of the stops where the zoning is favorable. So we know that property owners will be interested in buying if we're able to then create an economic development tool in this transition period in these neighborhoods that will allow us to lay down public works, that will allow us to make those local investments as just a small fragment of the total cost of all these different developments. That will allow property values to rise, property tax base to rise for city, county, school districts in the long term at a much faster rate than we would otherwise if we waited for public works capital cycles to throw down that infrastructure.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chairman, and to anybody at the table, I can't find the term in terms of years. How long do these districts last? TIF to me is usually 20 years, but is that the case here?
Sure, this is a normal economic development district, so it doesn't change that, but Mr. Cassidy can answer.
It is a maximum of 9 years.
9 years, okay.
But you can collect the tax increment. It may be shorter, but that would be the maximum.
Okay.
Chairman?
Mr. Casserly?
I don't know if this helps or not. I have a great deal of familiarity with the North Star line, and particularly with the issues that have evolved with putting in stations. Have been working on the Fridley station for several years now. And what we have funding for is the station itself, tunnels under the tracks, park and ride lots, and circulation within the immediate area. What we don't have resources for are signalization, semaphore lights, expanded right-of-ways, additional parking outside the area, bridges, additional roads accessing the area. There is a lot of infrastructure that we are going to be struggling with trying to create a maximum utilization of this area. I probably shouldn't mention this, but because both the House and the Senate have been very kind to us in the past and have provided us with special legislation that allows us to create a broader area in which we can collect, increment, and pool it for purposes of doing infrastructure around our Fridley station. And part of the reason that was done is because in order to even get the station there, we had to utilize some local resources. Anoka County had to put in funds of their own, and so on and so on. So legislature has treated us, has realized that we had a problem with our infrastructure and has assisted us with that. But we're not unique, and all the people who are along the line are now all struggling with trying to figure out how do they achieve maximum utilization and how do they find the funds for the infrastructure. What we have are numerous property owners, a lot of different parcels, and it would be we really can't assess for that. So we do have a real problem with it, and I assume that this is a problem that is prevalent throughout all of these systems, which is why the bill is here.
Mr. Casley, the Senate's been much kinder than the House in the case of Fridley.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair.
And as difficult as the Fridley one was, I can only imagine what the House is going to think about multiple locations like contained in this bill. Senator Dibble, I think probably the Minneapolis delegation needs to talk some about this and probably kind of further refine downward the request. When they can come to an agreement, the chair would like to know.
But Mr. Chair, we do have
a little broad.
We do have a gentleman from Coon Rapids. Indulge him for a few minutes.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Novinsky. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Coon Rapids. This isn't only a Minneapolis issue. This is a tool that suburbs like Coon Rapids, really could utilize. We are going to have two commuter rail stations eventually. We've got the Riverdale station to the west of Coon Rapids, or on the west side of Coon Rapids. That area is surrounded by about a 15-acre parcel and then a lot of single-family homes in the Riverdale Shopping Center to the north. We're trying to connect all of those areas, both this commercial area called Riverdale to the north, our single-family homes to the west and the east, into this 15 acres as that area redevelops so that our citizens and our businesses can connect to this commuter rail station. One of the challenges that we have, you may know already that the North Star commuter bus, coach bus, runs out of that station. And in the mornings and particularly in the evenings, Northdale Boulevard, which is the only access to that site, clogs up tremendously. And it's a major concern for our citizens and our neighborhoods about the access, how that access is going to change. So as part of the plan, you've got just a one-page handout that I've given you. Just kind of outlining some of the plans that we have for that area. We do need to create some better access points, not only into the station site itself, but also into that development area. And as was mentioned earlier, providing those connections, those signals, those trails into the site is very important. We also have on the east side near 610 along Foley Boulevard, another station that we call the Foley Station. And at some point, we expect that station to be up and running. Land has been purchased to place a station at that site. Immediately to the west of that site, the line that comes out of Minneapolis and heads towards St. Cloud splits off and goes north towards Cambridge, and we are in discussions and participating with the group putting together the Northern Lights Express. And we expect that we not only will have North Star, but Northern Lights Express and perhaps also some commuter rail coming down from Cambridge that will impact Coon Rapids. That site on the east side near 610 is unlike our area to the west, which is really a vacant site, but on the east side, this is a classic redevelopment area. We have a mix of older buildings, not all of them, because some of them actually are newer, wouldn't necessarily qualify under, say, a redevelopment district. This area also serves one of our major industrial sites, one of our major business and employment hubs. And so whatever we can do to facilitate redevelopment in that area provides us with a major boost to our economy in the Coon Rapids area. Quite frankly, we lost about $1.3 million in local government aid. We've laid off about six people, and we've got another four that are leaving. So we don't have a lot of money to do a lot of extra infrastructure projects. A tool like this gives us the ability to fund improvements locally, and quite honestly, as Senator Bach pointed out or questioned how much money we'd be taking off the tax rolls, This tool allows that decision to be made locally by our city council and prioritize their goals. So with that, I'll turn it back to Senator Dibble. Thank you.
Senator Dibble, any further?
No, thanks, Chair.
I think we need a little work here still. I mean, I think we've got to talk about, if we're going to do this, some kind of limitation on what we're going to capture. That's pretty big, other absent that. Senator Sundrum, anything further?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, we're all probably part of our own personal life experiences, but we had, where I came from, you know, certainly in a TIF district, fundamentally that TIF money was for land preparation, maybe demolition, asbestos removal, and so on. But then beyond that, a lot of these infrastructure issues were worked out in the development agreement and became the responsibility of the developer. And that's, you know, maybe it doesn't work everywhere like that, but that was certainly my experience in our city.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rochester had room to develop. Cities like Coon Rapids that are already developed and we have to redevelop really depend on TIF districts.
Mr. Chair, for the most part, what I just mentioned was about downtown development, so it was what we might call infill or refill.
Mr. Chair, that concept doesn't quite work, and as I described earlier, when you can't attribute that benefit and pull, you know, and do a bond issue on that premise. So that's why this concept is in front of us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair lays over Senate File 975. Member Senator Rest didn't make it in today, and I believe our witness on Senate File 331 is not here anymore, so we'll put that off to a later committee date. Next Tuesday, 8:30, we're going to have the department here and have a review of the most recently released tax incident study. This committee's adjourned.